Well, the eternity of God and man's frailty. Another title, The Somber Song of Moses, the Man of God. And there are some somber things there. Teach us to number our days, if you start flicking through commentaries or flicking through different study Bibles of various different titles given to the psalm. It's the only psalm that's attributed to Moses, although there are other songs that Moses wrote that are recorded in the book of Exodus and the book of Deuteronomy. Psalm 90 is the most personal of the three songs that Moses did write, a sad psalm, but not defeated or bitter. A recognition of our frailty, our sinfulness, and our need of God's grace is certainly within the psalm, isn't it? One commentator put it, there does not appear to be any trace of bitterness or of undue pessimism, just plain, realistic thinking marks these words. Moses is an elderly man. The context is found in the book of Numbers and chapter 20, and Miriam, his sister, has passed away. He has sinned and struck the rock and been told that he will not enter into the promised land, and then Aaron dies, and that must have been a terrible and a bitter blow. The older generation had been dying off as they'd been making their way through the wilderness towards the promised land. And so how many were there that Moses could really sit down and talk with about life back in Egypt or about the great redemption, deliverance and the exodus out of Egypt through the Red Sea and into the wilderness and the giving of the law and all the other things that began to happen and the giving of the manna and other things. How many people could he talk with about these things? Now, you don't need to be much of an observer of life to notice that old folk like to sit around often with old folk and talk about the good old days. Well, Moses now has lost his sister and finally his brother. He is the last one left from that generation, and it was a bitter and a terrible blow. And in the midst of all of this, as he himself knows that he will not be passing into the promised land, that he must die, and that Joshua and Caleb will take the people into the promised land. That's a bit of a blow, isn't it? To be a leader of Moses' caliber, if you like, and to be the man that God revealed his name to at the burning bush. And just think from Sunday school, if you went to Sunday school, or just the simple, obvious truths about Moses. And we can build up something of a picture, can't we, in our imagination this morning about the kind of man Moses was, the kind of things that Moses went through. And now at the end of his life, he has just lost his sister. And there was quite a number of years in his life that he didn't know that Miriam was his sister and Aaron, and they've been reunited, and I would imagine that that would have formed maybe an even stronger bond between them, and certainly all the things that they went through and the lives that they had. Try to imagine, how would you think? How would you respond? What would you say? What would you write if you were an elderly man, Moses, who's just lost his two closest family members, only family members if you like, and is now facing death himself? Now, for some of us here this morning, for some maybe listening on the internet, that's quite an easy thing to do. For others, particularly the younger ones amongst us maybe, that's a very, very hard thing to do, isn't it? Try to imagine yourself as an elderly man facing death who has just lost all of his remaining family. Well, that's what we've got to try and do this morning, isn't it? This is what motivated, this is what moved Moses to write the things that he wrote. At other times, Solomon, when he's a relatively young man and in love and about to marry, he writes a completely different thing altogether. And we find within the scriptures various different things, don't we? Some things are the most loveliest, the most joyful things. I almost can't wait. I almost am tempted to get up as early as some of you on a Sunday morning to get here and think and talk about them. Other things are a bit more serious, aren't they? Psalm 90 certainly reminds us of some pretty serious things as we come to the end of 1 year, as we close the chapter, if you like, or you put one of your diaries away and pull out your next one for the new year. first thing we're reminded as we break this psalm down and we try to just gloss over it together this morning, first thing we're reminded of is the eternal grandeur of God. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Verse 4, for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past, and like a watch in the night. Moses had seen much of the greatness and the eternal grandeur of God. An American word that's becoming more and more popular in the English language now is awesomeness. The awesomeness of God. That God is sublime. The magnitude, the enormity, the immensity, the splendor, the brilliance, the magnificence, the majesty and the glory of God. Moses knew a lot more, maybe, than most of us. He had seen something, hadn't he, at the burning bush. He had certainly seen more than something, hadn't he, up on Mount Sinai. And yet, even after all of this, he had been so drawn to it, so captivated by it, if you like, that he even prays, doesn't he, in the book of Exodus and chapter 33, please show me your glory. It's a good thing to memorize scripture, and it's a good thing to memorize prayers as well within the Bible, so that you can just enter and just lose yourself in fellowship with God, if you like, and just bounce backwards and forwards from text to text in the Bible. So very, very helpful. If you have a very good mind and you're good at remembering long passages, well, what a blessing from God. If you're like me and you're a bit like a goldfish that swims around the bowl and has forgotten what's happened by the time you've swum once or around, short little texts are good. He had seen the glory of God, hadn't he? And yet, praise, show me your glory. And now he's writing, isn't he, about the incomprehensibility or the transcendence of God. That God is infinite. God is eternal. He is everlasting. Now, I don't know, and I don't pretend to know a lot about physics. I didn't do very well at school and didn't do very well at physics. But I know that time is a dimension. And how on earth would you create time? None of us could even slow down or speed up. All of us are slaves, if you like, and subject to time. But we can grasp somewhat. We might not know as well as a professor of physics knows about time, and we might not know much about this, that, and everything else, but just try to think for a moment. We can't create anything. We couldn't create not a speck of dust, let alone the dimension of time. And Moses is reminding us of something of the grandeur of God, that he is everlasting, that he is transcendent, that he is outside of time. And according to his eternal and his infinite wisdom, it was wiser to create than not to create. And so he chose to create, and he didn't try to do it. He just spoke, didn't he? Time and everything around us into existence. And he had revealed to Moses, I am who I am. It's a verb and a word, if you like, that doesn't exist in the English language. It basically means what I eternally was, I am, and eternally will be. What I am right now, I eternally was and eternally will be. And what I eternally will be, I am and eternally was. But who can say such things? We almost can't, well, we can't grasp it. And yet God says, that is who and what I am. He is always greater than anything that could ever be said of him. Beyond language, beyond poetry. Poetry often is very, very helpful, isn't it, to help us to grasp something of this grand subject. Beyond the imagination. For me, it's looking at things on the television that's a very, very helpful to see images. I don't know if any of you have seen any of the Blue Planet As they delve down and they try to go deeper than they've ever gone before, and they still know that they've got miles deeper to go, and some of those creatures that are down there that had never been seen by the eyes of God knows them all. He designed them all. He made them all. He sustains them all. At other times, we can look with the naked eye, can't we? Across the plain or over the hills, and what do we see? At other times, we look through a telescope, we look up, and well, it's nothing more than just a dim reflection of the maker and the creator of all things. And he is our rock, our dwelling place and our refuge. And Moses knows that he has no fixed abode here. He knows that he is a pilgrim. He's traveling through life, literally traveling through the wilderness towards the promised land. But all of the poets and the and people that observe life, whatever religious background they're from or whatever pagan origin they have, it's not long, is it? And it's not really into your 20s or your 30s, really. All mankind everywhere just acknowledges that life is something like a journey. We go on lots of short little journeys, sometimes longer journeys maybe in life, but life is a journey, isn't it? We all acknowledge that. Well, Moses knows a bit more than the pagans, doesn't he? But he has his beginning with God. He is made and created by God, and he was there for such a time as this. He has his work, and he's allotted time to be there, and he is heading towards meeting God face to face, isn't he, in judgment. He knows that he has no fixed home. He is a pilgrim, and he needs something solid. He needs something beyond the superficial. I like the superficial. It's not very challenging, is it? It's just shallow. It's superficial. It's not very offensive. It's enjoyable. Nobody gets upset by it. It doesn't challenge us particularly deeply. And how sad, though, to stay and remain with nothing but the superficial. And we live in an age now, don't we, where the vast majority around us are stuck with the superficial. And that's all very good and wonderful when you're healthy and well and young and you've got enough money and this, that and everything else. But when people are dying around you and when you're facing your own death and mortality, you need something more than the superficial, don't you? When you lose a loved one, when you have a terminal illness, you need something more than the superficial. When something or someone that you dearly love and appreciate is taken away, you need more than the superficial, don't you? And Moses is acknowledging here that God is my rock. God and God alone, the one who is eternal and transcendent and everlasting, is the only thing that is of any real substance and worth to me at this point. He's a rock, isn't he? A solid rock. Now, it's hard for the young people maybe to grasp this, but we hope that you do while you're younger rather than older. Easier for the older people and relatively easy for those who are middle-aged like myself. We need something to build our lives upon. We need something of substance. We need something that is faithful. We need something that is strong and mighty. We need something that will not let us down. And we see all around us, don't we? The politicians letting us down, the education system letting us down, sometimes our spouses letting us down, our children letting us down sometimes. Life is full of disappointments, isn't it? Well, Moses has just lost all remaining relatives and is facing death. What is there of any substance? What can I lean upon? What will give me strength? What will give me hope? The eternal grandeur of God. Well, the psalm moves on, and we must as well this morning. We see the frailty and the fragility of man, if you like. Verse 3, you turn man to destruction and say, return, O children of men. In verse 5 and 6, you carry them away like a flood. They are like a sleep in the morning.
They are like grass which grows up. In the morning it flourishes and grows up. In the evening it is cut down and withers. He's contrasting, isn't he, our mortality, if you like, with his immortality. That we are finite and he is infinite. That we are frail and he is omnipotent. That we are fragile and delicate. He is overpowering. That we are transient and temporal and he is eternal. That we are unstable and he is an eternal rock. And though the desert after night rain or a heavy dew can produce a blanket of grass, sun rises, it quickly, soon disappears. You don't need to be much of an observer of life, do you, to realize that all those whom we would call elderly, and respectfully so, say that life goes so very, very quickly. The older you get, the quicker it goes. I've never understood this, and I scratched my head for years about this. Why is it that older folks say that time seems to go so very, very quickly? And why is it that time seems to be going quicker for me? Well, somebody told me once. They said, look, when you're young, a year is a sixth or a tenth of your experience. Your mind is absorbing and receiving information and this, that, and the other. And a year, if you're 10 years old, is a tenth of your experience. Of all that you know, of all that you've experienced, of all that you've received and everything else, a year is a tenth of your life. Well, when you get to 60 or 70, it's only a short, tiny little fraction. And so in your mind, that's how you deal with time. Now as you get older and older, it just seems to go so very, very quickly. It just seems to fly by. And Moses is looking at the eternality of God. That he has no beginning and he has no end. And he says, look at us. 70 years is the average. In Africa, that would be a very, very elderly gentleman. In China, it would be relatively young to pass away. But that's going to be it for the vast majority of people throughout the world in which we live in. It's going to be about 70 and if not 80 years. And for some people, it may be a little, but only a little longer. He moves on now. Now, Moses is the one who wrote Genesis, didn't he? He recorded Genesis chapter 3. He recorded, didn't he, God's voice to Adam, saying to Adam, the day that you eat from the tree, you will die. So now he's going to connect death and sin. Why is there death? Why are we mortal? Why are we so frail? Why is it we only get 70 and possibly 80 years? Why are we so fragile and delicate and finite? Sin. Verse 7. For we have been consumed by your anger and by your wrath. We are terrified. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance. For all our days have passed away in your wrath. We finish our years like a sigh. The days of our lives are 70 years, and if by reason of strength they're 80 years. Yet their boast is only labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off and we fly away. Who knows the power of your anger? For as the fear of you, so is your wrath. So teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Why is God angry? What on earth could possibly make God angry? If God is love. And we love to think about that. Oh, we studied 1 John, didn't we, during the year. And we went over and over again about why we should love one another. The importance of love, the supremacy of love. We love him because he first loved us. And God is love. As God is eternal, as God is infinite, as God is transcendent, as God is grand and glorious and majestic, and all of those things beyond poetry or our imagination or even the television ever to portray to us. So God is love. He's kind, he is good, he is patient, he is long-suffering. The more and more I get to read the Bible, the more and more I get to know God, the more and more I marvel at myself standing here week by week. The more and more I marvel that God has spared me another year. And these things are true. But why is he angry? Why did he say, the day that you eat from the tree, you will die? Why did he cast them out of the garden? I mean, why is there a flood? Why is there these judgments of God? Why does the earth sometimes even swallow people up? Why is there the cross where God's beloved Son, the one whom he loves infinitely and eternally, punished at the cross? Why is God angry? Why does God pour out his wrath? Why is there death? Because God is holy. Because God is righteous. Because God is just. That's who he eternally is. Eternally was and eternally will be. He's not going to change. He is infinitely, absolutely perfect. And so Moses is dealing with reality here. He's not dealing with what I hope and wish and what I can poetically conjure up to try to deceive myself away from the reality of death, judgment and eternity. No, I want to look at things as they really are, Moses is saying. And the reason why Miriam is dead, the reason why Aaron is dead, the reason why I am going to die, the reason why I am not going to enter into the promised land is because of sin. Our greatest problem, although you can say death and our fragility, our mortality and all of the other things that are highlighted are huge problems for us. Our greatest problem is not our fragility, but the fact that we are all sinners subject to the just wrath of God. Moses wrote Genesis chapter 3. He knows that death is the judgment of God against sin. And the psalm is not so much a comparison between the holiness of God and our sinfulness, but linking death and sin together. And so he reminds us of it. When you're dying, the shallow superficialities of money, of hobbies, of sports, of enjoyment, of pleasure, of the media and entertainment, all of those things will be taken away and will be utterly meaningless to you. Dare I even say it, when we're dying, if we face death like Moses, even our closest relatives and dearly loved ones will somewhat disappear, and it will be our sin, and it will be God. And it will be judgment and other most serious things that we will be considering and thinking about. Well, we thank God that there is mercy, grace, hope, light, his goodness, kindness, and the gospel. And that's how Moses finishes. It's a black backdrop, admittedly, but not a lie. It's not a facade. It's reality, isn't it? The grandeur of God, the frailty of mankind, his fragility, his mortality, our sin and the just judgment of God because of who he is against it. The psalm finishes with Moses praying. And this is how we finish our year, maybe, or Jim will finish us off. I think Jim's going to more point us towards the coming year, but as we finish on the last day of the year, we finish with Moses praying about our great need of grace. He appeals in verse 12, so teach us, that was the word that we had for the children, wasn't it? Teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Where are you? Are you at the beginning of your life? Are you looking forward to potentially many, many decades ahead of you? Are you looking forward to meeting somebody, falling in love, marrying? Are you looking forward to buying your first property? Are you looking forward to many things in the future? I don't know. Have you gotten most of those things already and you're middle-aged like myself? Are you near the end? I don't know. You have to think for yourselves this morning, don't you?
teach us to number our days, that we have a heart of wisdom. That even if you're very young here this morning, you are not guaranteed to be here next year. I'm not guaranteed to be here next year. Nobody's guaranteed to be here next year. That's wisdom, isn't it? See, the world is caught up, isn't it? In Vanity Fair, as John Bunyan put it. And they're dancing and they're singing, and you can go down into the town or any of the towns and the cities, and they'll be dancing and singing and drinking, and maybe, rightly so. Not on a Sunday, but a New Year's Eve, rightly so. If you are celebrating and somewhat having a drink and thanking God for his providential mercies to you in a past year, and you're enjoying some time of knowing that you don't have to go to work the next day, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. But many will be dancing and singing with no thought of God whatsoever, as if they are guaranteed to be doing the same thing next year. And none of us are. Teach us to number our days. The Bible tells us constantly, doesn't it? Yes, there's lots of superficial things in life, and God creates the superficial for us. In actual fact, he says you can be predominantly involved in the superficial for 6 days. Enjoy your work. Enjoy your wife and your spouse, as we're going to be looking at in the book of Proverbs very, very soon as we study that book. Enjoy your food. Enjoy a drink even, as long as you don't get drunk. Enjoy these things. Have these things. Receive them gratefully from the gracious, good hand of God. But Moses reminds us that we need to have a heart of wisdom and we need to number our days. A lesser poet wrote, "Only one life will soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last." Now, it doesn't compare with the psalmist, admittedly, and many of our hymns. But that's the truth of it. That's the truth of it. Moses appealed secondly that mercy would satisfy and gladden him in verses 14 and 15. "Oh, satisfy us early with your mercy that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad according to the days in which you have afflicted us, the years in which we have seen evil." It's why we pray for the young people, have a children's talk, do all the youth work. We want you to come to know the mercy of the Lord in your early years. God is not for when you're middle-aged like myself. God is not just for when you are elderly, although he is for us in our middle-age and in our elderly years. But he's praying, isn't he, that the Lord's mercy will come to the lives of the people in their young years, and that they will enjoy the mercy and the goodness of God in their young years, so that they will have gladness and joy all the days of their lives. The one and only thing that will secure lifelong gladness is a heart satisfied with the experience of God's love. The only thing that will secure lifelong gladness is a heart satisfied with the experience of God's love. There is nothing else. There will not be anything else. As Augustine famously said, "You have made us for yourselves, and our hearts are restless till they find their rest in thee." And we can go from one hobby, from one relationship, from this, that, everything else, whether it's job, whether it's family, and everything else that's out there on offer to us. And you can go from one to the next, and you gain that and have that, and then you've got to try to hold on to it, and that won't satisfy you, so you go for another, and you try to get your fill of that, and then you try to hold on to it, don't you? And your heart as a human being will never be fully satisfied, fully joyful, fully at peace, unless you experience the love of God. And so Moses prays that this thing will happen for all the young Israelites, not just for the elderly ones like himself, but in our young years. May all of us as a nation, he's praying, know the mercy and the goodness, the covenant love of God in our early years, that we can have a glad heart. If you were to ask the older folk here, what's most important in life? gladness, joy, and peace would be at the top of the list. Money and other things would be very much down the bottom of the list, but we kind of flip-flop over, don't we? The things that we think that are so important when we're young, we realize when we're old are not that important. The most important thing is to be glad, to have peace, to have joy in your heart, which can only come if you're resting on the rock of who God is in Jesus Christ. He appeals for these things, doesn't he? Thirdly, Moses appeals that God himself will work and reveal his glory in verse 16. Let your work appear to your servants and your glory to their children. Something that Moses saw, didn't he, at the burning bush and up Mount Sinai, and yet carries on praying in Exodus chapter 33. Show me your glory. Revive your work in the midst of the years. In wrath, remember mercy, is how Habakkuk put it. That's important, isn't it? As we end the year, we thank God for all that he's done, all the kids that have come, everything else that's happened in the toddlers groups and everything else in the residential homes and in the marketplace and everything. We're very, very thankful for all that God, but we're saying, Lord, work and continue to reveal more of your glory. He comes to a close, and familiar words and much loved words by me, and let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us. That God would sanctify us and transform us and change us. And this is where the clock is ticking and time is running out for me, and I'm going to ask you to think about this for yourself. What weakness spiritually as a believer do you have? See, there are some things that God will allow us to be tempted in that mean nothing to us. We just laugh at it. It won't challenge us at all. And the devil himself, who can only be in one place at one time and probably will never come anywhere near me whatsoever, personally and directly, but even if he could, he would come with certain temptations and they would be absolutely nothing to me at all. It just does not attract me in the least. But there are other things that are very attractive. Other things where I do not need to be tempted very much at all. Other areas where I am very weak and very frail. And it's the same for every believer here this morning. What are those areas for you? For some, it is Sunday. You know notionally that you need to commit Sunday to God, but it's a struggle to do so. For others, it's money. You know that you need to commit, don't you, towards the work of the gospel here and abroad. But that's a struggle for you. For others, it's the internet. For others, it's impatience. For others, it's just a lack of zeal and courage for the Lord. We all stumble, James tells us, in many, many ways. May the beauty of the Lord be upon us. Because there's no weakness in him. There's no chink in his armor. There's no frailty in him. There's no imperfection in him. And when we look at God standing incarnate before us in Jesus Christ, is there any lack of courage? Is there any lack of zeal? Is there any disobedience? Is there any worldliness? Is there any pride? Is there any lack of heavenliness and spirituality? Is there any lack of joy and peace and love? Is there any lack of compassion and concern towards those who are around him and needing nothing? So much so that his closest friends and all the apostles say that, well, there is no sin in him at all. And we have to look to him, don't we? And we have to look to the areas where we are weak and the areas where we struggle. And we look to the Lord Jesus Christ and say, you were tempted in all ways, and yet in that area you were not weak. Help me. Teach me to be more like you in that area so the beauty of the Lord can be upon me. That I can be more like him. That's what we need, isn't it? That's our greatest thing. We could go on, I tell you, till next week about what the church needs right now. Well, maybe top of the list is that those who are believers would be more like Jesus.
May the beauty of the Lord be upon us. And the beauty of the Lord is upon his people in many ways. And we see the light and the love and the joy and the peace and the sacrifice and the courage and the zeal and the dedication and the humility of Christ in various different degrees and different ways in all of God's people, don't we? But may the beauty of the Lord be upon us. Because he's perfect, not just in a few areas, but in every sense of the word. That's a great thing to pray, isn't it? At the end of the year and the beginning of a new one. And that our work may be established. Yes, establish the work of our hands. We close with this morning. This is how he prayed. I had a very sad conversation with somebody just yesterday who was saying the end of the year has come, and I look back and I wonder, what have I actually accomplished and achieved? What have I actually done this year? And I thought, well, even in your best years, what have you really accomplished and achieved? What have you really done for the glory of God? What have you done that's really gold, silver and precious? What have you really done that's not wood, hay and stuff? What have you really done that was living for a better resurrection? What have you really done that is storing treasures in heaven rather than here on earth? It was quite a sad and a sobering thing to hear somebody say and to think about for a few moments. Moses served God. He was known as the servant of God. And so he said, establish the work of my hands. Yes, Moses worked to feed himself. Yes, Moses worked to provide a tent for himself. Yes, Moses worked to do all manner of other things that he personally benefited by. And rightly so. 6 days, Moses wrote, we should work, and the seventh we should rest. But Moses knew he was a servant of God, and that much of his time and life was devoted towards doing things that God wanted him to do. And he prayed at the end of his life, establish the work of our hands. There's not much time left for me, Moses is saying. But there are many in the nation who are young. Establish the work of our hands. Do you think like this? Or is this completely foreign to you? Is this like looking into the mind, if you like, of a total alien? Or in actual fact, something like looking into your own mind? That many of the sentiments, many of the thoughts, many of the ideas, many of the desires that we find on the lips and mind of Moses are within the mind, within the desires, within your own life. The whole point and purpose of us reading and looking at the Bible is to, if you like, as a mirror, it reveals ourselves, doesn't it? It shows us where we are. For some of us here this morning, you may well have memorized Psalm 90, really put it into practice. It's a real big part of your life and existence. For others of us, maybe it's caught us a bit of a challenge and short. Certainly, if you're an unbeliever here this morning, this is how you need to think. As we remember, this is who we praise and pray to. We don't forget our frailty and our sinfulness. We are prepared to meet God and give an account as Moses was, as all the way through the psalm. He talks about time and days, life and death. We too would want to make the same five appeals. That we would think spiritually and have a heart of wisdom. That God's covenant love would satisfy and gladden us all the days of our lives. That God himself will work and reveal his glory in our midst. That the beauty of the Lord would be upon us. And all that we do will endure and be of lasting value. Pretty good way, isn't it, for us to end a year and think about beginning a new one. May the Lord help us to put these things into practice, that we are not foolish hearers, but effectual doers of God's word. Amen.